Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are still smiling in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well then, last week we asked for a reaction to our performance at Luton and by Jove did we get one. A comprehensive victory over our biggest rivals sent us all home with a warm go, which, let's face it, we're all still basking in. And it gave a great end to a difficult week as there have been quite a few dissenting voices as we didn't add any ready-made players to our squad as the window closed. But with some of our walking wounded returning and with Japan being eliminated from the Asian club, thanks Ali J, and Kurumatoma should be back in the fold for this weekend's trip to Spurs. And we did add highly rated trio Kalen Vickers, Josh Robertson and Kamari Doyle to the under-21s. In other news, there was a shock as women's boss Melissa Phillips was relieved of her duties an hour after hosting a press conference ahead of the Seagulls game at Man United. Mickey Harris has been put in temporary charge. And it's all changing the fixture diary once again as our games against Liverpool, Man City and Forest have all been moved to Sundays. Joining me today, as ever, is Alan Wears, and we are delighted to welcome back Vicky Rees as we look back on last weekend and just, well, laugh. So welcome back, Vicky. How are you feeling? We all left the ground very happy on Saturday night, didn't we?
Oh, I certainly did. I managed to get through dry January, and I opted against having a drink before Luton, which in hindsight might have been a bad idea. But I thought, you know what, this is the day to break it after that result against Palace.
And you did. It was. We had a lovely time in the pub, but you didn't, Al, because you had the lurgy.
You're not making any friends here, mate. I mean, I've probably missed about two or three league games since. Home game since the Amex opened. One of them was the 3-0 win, I think it was, against Spurs when Lloris bent his arm back in the first minute. I missed that. And there may have been one or two others, but yes. But having said that, I'm going to take one for the team. Hey, if it means I miss a game and we manage to finally slaughter Palace, then, you know, karma has its just desserts. I feel a lot better now. So, you know, whenever the next home game is Everton. Oh, it's Everton. Oh, God, what's going to... Yeah, but I'll see if I can get ill for that as well.
But, I mean, going into the game, Vicky, I mean, there was obviously the game at Luton. We knew it happens. We said that we did this last week and we kind of like did it like a kind of like a group therapy thing. And the fact that, you know, we've all been following this team for long enough to know that, you know, if you dwell on it, that's when it becomes a problem. And if you repeat it straight away, then it becomes a bigger problem. So we are looking for a reaction and we got one.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go into the game feeling wildly optimistic, but that wasn't really as a result of the Luton game. I think, you know, we are one of those teams. We do have that kind of performance in us now and again. We know that, but we also know that we have this astonishing record of not losing successive games very often. And I think, aren't we on the longest run in the Premier League of not doing that from any team? So I wasn't optimistic in the sense that I thought we would smash them, but that was purely based on history. And for the last few years, barring maybe one game, we've dominated Palace. We have been all over them in most of those games. We just haven't managed to put the ball in the net, or we have put the ball in the net, but somebody else has dropped it in the net or passed it to them at the other end. Yeah. So that was my thing. And I just thought, well, you know, it'll probably be the same old story. We'll play them off the park and then we will concede a stupid goal and draw like we always do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, bizarrely, one of the games that you're talking about that we didn't dominate was the game we won last year 1-0 when they actually turned up for a change.
Well, that's just...
Yeah, go on. No, Palace did, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think they were terrific in that game, but they were slightly less poor than they have been in other ones. But I think, you know, the game when Morpé equalised, that wasn't a terrific Albion performance. But by and large, we have absolutely dominated them. If you look at the possession stats can tell all sorts of stories. But if you look at that and the way we've played compared to the way they play, you know, they can sit there and feel sorry for themselves and say, well, you know, just one of those days and they'll bang on about their injuries and all that. But actually, that result's been coming for a long time.
I mean, just to add to Vicky's point there, if you remember a couple of years ago, I think it was Potter's last full season with us, we had the two games. I think we drew one all up there, lost 2-1 here in front of empty stadiums, where we had a ridiculous figure of something like 54 shots on target, 75% possession. They had three. They scored from all three of them. It's we have by and large dominated them, but I think that probably that there was that perfect storm. I mean, I take Vicky's point. Actually, I think you probably have clarified a couple of things in my mind here. You don't go into the game wildly optimistic. One, because it's Palace, and I say, as you point out, we do choke when we play them a bit. But the Luton game had seemed to have been a little bit of a culmination of what had gone for the previous two 0-0 games, where, yeah, it was great that we didn't concede, but we didn't exactly sort of play our usual free-flowing attacking football either.
Yeah.
And then you actually add that to the Luton game, where we didn't play our free-flowing attacking football, and Luton turned up and made us suffer and sweat for it. And so it is, like you say, it's one of those where it's... I liken it to sort of someone who you can see is just nodding off, and then they just go back. Oh, did I fall asleep there? Yes, he did, and we lost 4-0. Yeah. You've woken up, we won 4-1. Yeah, that team does not become rubbish overnight, and so it knows how to play. It just didn't against Luton.
Okay, Vicky. Well, let's get into that then, because there were changes to the team. As I said at the intro, we're starting to get some of our walking wounded back, and one of the key features of those games that we failed to score, and obviously the Luton game as well, was that there wasn't as much width. And in this game, we actually welcomed back Tarek Lamptey, and it made a world of difference.
Yeah, I think so, because one of the criticisms, I suppose, is that in the absence of Mitoma and March and Dingra and Nciso, we've certainly lacked width, but I think at times we've lacked that change of pace as well. And the one thing that Lamptey brings is pace. He seems to be a slightly different player to what he was when he first arrived in the team, what is it, 3 or 4 years ago? But you know, maybe there's still a little bit of psychology in that for him, because he's had so many injuries, and maybe he's not quite in that mental place where he's going to go absolutely flat out. But he certainly has the turn of pace to get past somebody, and that's what he did a couple of times early on. He won the corner that the first goal came from. He pulled the ball back for Hinchelwood's goal. You know, just that. You know, he gave their defence something to think about, and that's what we haven't had for a couple of months, probably, with injuries and Mitoma. Even when he was in the team, he'd slightly gone off the boil. So I think he's brought that back to the team. How long it lasts, you know, we can only keep our fingers crossed that he gets a bit of a good run now.
I mean, there was a fallout from the Palace side of it, where they didn't have Eze playing. At least they were only fit enough for the bench, or so they thought, until Roy threw their medical team under the bus. But I mean, we've seen this with Lallana, we've seen it with Lamptey. When they've come back too soon, they've only lasted a couple of minutes on the pitch, and that's exactly what happened with Elise.
And it was very funny. This is obviously very unfortunate. And what I would say is that, you know, Elise is a spectacularly talented player. He's probably the one player in that Palace team that I think I would bite your hand off for, because I think he's a game changer. Yes, they talk about they've got some other decent players in there, but Gay, for example. I don't think Gay's anything, you know, better than what we already have. He certainly wouldn't fork out money for him. And I've honestly never seen Eze have a good game against us. I'm not saying he isn't a good footballer, but he's never had the game. Whereas Elise is an absolute game changer. And, you know, we were all sat there at half time and we thought, you know, this is, aside from the elation, but there is still that little bit of, you know, this is the Albion. We know we can concede goals. We saw from the Spurs game that there was a little bit of panic set in when they got one and then they got another, and it was like, oof. But I think, you know, we were a bit worried about that. And then we were all talking about it. Do you think he'll bring Elise on? And I remember saying to the others, if he's only fit enough to be on the bench, is it even worth it at this point? But then there must be some onus on the player there. And I've said this to other people today, that you know, he's a footballer there. He's got some responsibility. He must know whether he's fully fit or not. And if he is, maybe it's just one of those things and it's not Hodgson's fault or the medical team's fault. And if he's not, well, surely it's down to him to say, I'm not quite fit. So that was very, very funny. But from a purely vindictive football fan's point of view, him coming on and then...
I'm hoping you're not sort of finding his injury funny.
Well, at the end of the day, he's pulled a hamstring, isn't he, Al? I don't think it's anything that's going to ruin his life, but you know, you could laugh. I think you can chuckle at that. The funny thing was when that ball was passed forward and Gilmore charged off after it, and then he didn't realise that Elise had stopped, and Gilmore sort of stops, puts his foot on the ball, turns around, and then he has this brief moment of, where's he gone? He was on his own, middle of the park. And Elise is holding his hamstring and doing the rolling hands, take me off sign, and then suddenly there was this big cheer go around the Amex, not for the first time that afternoon. So, you know, it was quite funny. Wished ill on him as a human being, but it was very funny that their star player went off injured again.
Yeah. I mean, Garth Crooks, who we all know has got his finger on the pulse of what goes on in the world and clearly watches every single minute of every single football match in the world ever. And when he named his BBC team of the week this week, Eberechi Eze was in it. Shame he wasn't even on the bench.
I can only assume he's picked him from their win against, was it Brentford they played? Sheffield United, wasn't it? Must have been that, but it didn't really, you know, I think perhaps, yeah, I'm not sure quite that was the way for him to go, but this is Garth Crooks, isn't it? So he lives in his own world.
I just can't believe it. That's brilliant. Anyway, but in other earth-shattering, shocking news, Al, we score from a corner.
We do it now and again. It has happened. I think there was a time when Gary Williams took one, and I think possibly Steve Foster headed in. That might have been one. But also, it was just such a silly one. I mean, the pundits sort of having a look at everything after the game, and Brighton starting off with their soul train and then sort of splitting and what have you. And again, that's a tactic I've really seen work. I just thought it was just the fact that whoever it was, and this is something that actually so many times Brighton defenders or midfielders coming back to defend are so guilty of, is they just didn't pick up the main man. Lewis Dunk is clearly the tallest person in the team. I think he even towels over Jason Steele, but not that Steele goes up for a corner.
I think you might find Van Heck is taller than Dunk.
I'm not so sure about that, but my point is that, you know, they basically left Dunk on his own. And for once, he didn't balloon it straight into row Z with his head. It was just sort of like the tiniest of little... It was like when you're walking down the street and you see someone approaching that you know, but you don't really want to talk to. You just sort of like incline your head and nod very, very subtly just to sort of acknowledge the person that you don't really want to talk to as you go past them. That was Dunk's header.
I think it was Anderson that he outjumped, which looking at the footage again, I think you probably couldn't get a copy of the Times under his feet. That's how far he got off the ground. I'm not even talking about the Sunday Times hit. He didn't have a good afternoon either, did he? Because he also then got put on his arse by Pascal Gross for the third goal.
Yes.
So he had a satisfyingly unsatisfactory afternoon.
And then had a ruck with the Palace fans as well.
Well, he's supposed to be another one of their stars, isn't he? I'm not entirely convinced about Anderson, but there we go.
No, I mean, the point is that for all the bits of individual, you know, who's good enough, collectively they clearly weren't. Collectively, we clearly were. I mean, for any individual, they'll say, right, who of that 11 would you have? Who of this 11 would you have? And I think that really misses the point, especially when you're coming to talk about Brighton. Yes, there are players who are individual and the likes of Pedro get the headlines and Ferguson has been getting the headlines, although he's gone off on the boil. Pascal Gross is forever going to be one of those underrated talents. But actually, it still misses the point. Yes, you need quality players. You need high-quality players. But it counts for nothing. And I'm looking at you, London Cowboys. You can have all the talent in the world. If you can't function as a team, you're not doing anything. You're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what happened. I mean, Palace are not individually rubbish. Collectively, they are.
Well, I stand corrected, by the way. Lewis Dunk is two centimetres taller than Van Heck. I did not know that.
Yeah, but you also said that Jack Hinshaw was 5'7", so I'm not really going to take your height measurement seriously. He's actually about as tall. He's taller than me, you know. So
There you go.
Talking of Hinshelwood, one, that header that he does to score is soon going to become a trademark, I'm sure of it, the one that goes across the area. And two, and I thought this is immediately as soon as he scored, I wonder if his granddad is now sort of spinning in his grave a little bit. I mean, is he the first Hinshelwood to score in this fixture, given how many have played in it before?
I think he is. We were going to look this up, weren't we? I might have a look in a minute, but I think that Paul Hinshelwood might have scored.
Yeah,
a few obviously back in the day, but I'd need to just double check that.
One thing that I hope that doesn't happen to Jack Hinshelwood,
let's stand,
given the family history, is him retiring in his mid-20s, you know, the height of his career.
Yeah.
Dad had to. Paul and Martin's careers were cut short. I hope he's built of more stout stock, because even at 18, there is clearly, and he is, of all those that we've seen play, and there are others who sort of like were on the periphery a few years ago, he is head and shoulders above all the rest of that clan. I know he's still only 18, but it surely won't be long before he's going to be in the England under-21s as a youth, you know, as a sort of, you know, one of the nappy wearers, because for me, you know, like I say, a dozen games into his Albion career, he is as comfortable and as confident as someone who is 150 games into their Albion career.
That's true, but it's also as a fullback when he's meant to be a midfielder. So, I mean, call him up to the 21s as a fullback.
I think the question for me there, and I mean this in an entirely positive way, I have no idea, other than what I've been told, I have no idea what Jack Hinshelwood's best position is. And I mean that in a really positive way, because he's come into the team. He's actually scored, what, 3 goals now as well, which is an unexpected bonus. He's really done nothing wrong. I don't actually think he's done anything spectacular, but for an 18-year-old to come into a Premier League side and not to do anything wrong and to hold down his place week after week when he's been played out of position, that's where the skill lies. If I say I don't know what he does, that's not meant to be derogatory in the slightest.
No.
I haven't seen what his role is, and I don't know. Yeah, he may well be. I heard someone saying earlier today he is a central defensive midfielder. And I thought, well, I can't see him in that kind of... Because that says to me like a Caicedo role, for argument's sake, and I can't really see it with his build and his stature, but maybe he is, and maybe that's where he'll go in the end. But it's just... He's just been so comfortable and he just gets on with it and does stuff. He doesn't do anything spectacular apart from those bonus goals I've talked about.
He
gets on with it and doesn't really do anything wrong, which is amazing.
I mean, we have been lacking goals from defence as well from the last few years. I mean, we've had, actually, I mean, Estupiñán's weighed in with a few this year. I think, is that 2 for Dunk now this season? I need to check.
Yeah, it's about time. I mean, then we've just got Jan Paul to go. But yeah, I mean, this is the point. The one time I think we've seen him playing in the central midfield, he played alongside Dahoud. And we lost 6-1. Now, it's not his fault, far from it, but I'm afraid to say that particular day, he looked A, out of position, and B, a rabbit in the headlights. It's an unfortunate blooding of him. And if we're going to see him as that central midfielder that he has so far played his junior career as being, plus it's his preferred position, then great. But I think that, oddly enough, is going to take more time to settle in, just because he hasn't really played that position well in the first team. Great that he's played it for the juniors that way. And yet, when he plays out wide in a central / progressive role down mostly the right-hand side, he looks... I'm going to disagree with Vicky a little bit. He hasn't been spectacular, but he's been way better than we could have actually hoped for.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think he's done a really good job, and that's all you can sort of say, isn't it? You some of these players that come in at a very young age and they just look like absolute superstars. And I don't think I'd put him in that bracket, but I just think he's come in and looked very much at home, and that's a compliment. That is really meant to be a compliment.
Yeah,
one player that probably been a bit of a slow burner, it's taken a while to fully get up to speed. And that is a certain player that scored the third goal of the day, Vicky.
Oh, I love him. You see, I like Buonanotte, I think. There are certain games, you know, he's still got a lot to learn. And I think we've discussed it before on here. I'm sure you have, even without me. is that, you know, he is not a wide player. He's got really good football brain. He's a good passer of the ball. He sees stuff. He's got a lot of skill. And I think, you know, he's someone that you need to be playing in the middle. And when he does play in the middle and it's the right kind of game for him, then that's where he's going to be effective. And it feels like at the moment he's kind of floating around a bit between the front and the sort of midfield there. Yeah. And that's giving him the freedom to do stuff. There are still moments. He's actually a lot stronger now than he first was. I think his first season was probably a bit another rabbit in the headlights and getting used to his football. And let's not forget, he's 18 years old. He's moved thousands of miles from home. Completely new culture. He doesn't speak the language, and that's going to be really tough for anybody. You know, if you think what the rest of us were doing when we were 18, it wasn't moving from South America to the UK and, you know, surrounded in an environment you're surrounded by adults, all of that kind of thing. So
I was probably trying to go the other way.
he's had an awful lot to deal with, and he said himself in that interview, didn't he, that he found it really tough. I think that the light bulb moment for me was that Man City game last season, towards the end of the season, the home match, and I thought he was superb in that. And I think, you know, he's getting stronger. He still stays down a bit long sometimes when he's been like the tackle. And I wish
it is a South American trait, unfortunately. But
when he's got the ball back, that's frustrating. When if we then win the ball back and he's still sitting on the floor, but he'll get that out of him. And I think there are still certain games. I think right from the start at Luton, I thought, I don't know if this is going to be his kind of game. A bunch of massive guys. They've all come up from the Championship, you know, most of them have, and, you know, they're going to run and kick. They were excellent. I'm not being derogatory. They were really, really good. But I thought right from the start, I can't see this being Buonanotte's night. And so it proved. But
I felt they targeted him a bit as well, actually. I mean, this is the celebration I put upon him. This is that there's more than one team. And I think that certainly Palace started doing, Luton definitely did it, Sheffield United did it to a certain extent, as they were targeting him. Now, like you say, he is a little bit stronger than he was before, as opposed to just going down like a sack of spuds. And he does have to learn sort of, sorry, mate, you're not at the chocolate box anymore. You are in England. I liken it back to Cucurella's debut at Brentford, where he gets absolutely smashed. I mean, what should have been a red card? And Lewis Dunk, instead of saying, you know, up you get, mate, you know, it's all right, you know, we'll sort it out. Dunk just went to Cucurella's, welcome to the Premier League, son. You just got to get on with it. And even about two or three games ago, Vicky, I think you could see the referee doing it. He booked Buonanotte for waving the imaginary yellow card. It's those aspects of the game that, yeah, all right, he's still 18, 19, whatever it is. And we forget that he is, you know, certainly a work in transition. And like I say, we've had an improvement out of him for just under half a season. And the improvement is clear. But, you know, let's have this conversation in a year's time and let's see how much that improvement is.
Well, I mean, let's hope so. I think, you know, there's been, you know, you've only got to look at the social media side of things. And I think the kind of the Latin American contingent all seem very close off the pitch. They're all going out. You know, I saw the pictures of them out for Purvis's birthday, I think it was, and you think that's got to be really good in helping you settle in. You've got people around you that, yes, I'm sure he's learning the language, but to have people that you can just chat to normally off the pitch must be good for him. We've got another one coming in Barco, so and I think he already knows Barco as well, so you know that'll all help. And I think, you know, whether he retains his place regularly once Ansu Fati's back, once Matoma's back, Adingra's back, and Ciso's back, who knows? But I think he's holding his own at the moment, and obviously he's got a great song if you're a South American.
I was going to say, have you enjoyed this South American commentary on Buonanotte's goals so far, Bex?
I certainly have. I've spent 3 days singing it, which is a lot better than
But I mean, obviously this goal lent as much to Pascal Gross and Pedro as it did to Buonanotte. I mean, let's face it, he did finish it with Alan.
With some plums.
With some plums.
That's a weird thing. I was curious about it. I mean, let's face it, it really is nitpicking. Why didn't Pascal Gross have a shot for himself? Especially after he put, who was it? You say Anderson, he put him on the back, his backside.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was actually Gross that won the ball back. I mean, it was almost a 1-2 with Pedro, but it was like, It was like he was just taking his dog for a walk. Oops, there you go, on your backside, son, and just slid it in.
What was quite cathartic, I think, was the timing of those goals and the way they worked, the way they panned out. Because I think if you're at Luton, as I was, sadly, for my one and only visit, that, you know, Luton scored very early on. We scored very early on against Palace. And then they scored again from the kickoff at Luton, which is what effectively we did to Palace. Because I hadn't really thought of it, you know, during the game, but I'm watching the highlights for about the 18th time. it was pretty much from the kickoff, wasn't it? They passed it back to their new boy, and then he promptly dithered around and got robbed, and we went and scored again. So it was very satisfying.
I could give you the exact timings. It was 80 seconds between each goal, but it was 14 seconds from the kickoff.
Yeah, because it was allowing enough time for us to celebrate and give it large.
Yes, and then gave it larger still. And what I actually love about the third goal, because like you say, you've watched it, you know, 18 times. What I like watching, sort of just on sort of that sort of 8-second loop repeat, is I like to look at each individual player when the ball hits the net. Some of them throw their arms up, some just go and run towards the Pascal Gross just ran the other way, completely the other way. You had Buonanotte and all the rest of them heading towards the southwest corner. Pascal Gross was running the other way. It was almost Keystone Cops hilarious. What I really enjoyed was, and if you get a chance to see it again, because you will for the 53rd time, next time you watch it, is Jack Hinshelwood at the bottom of the screen. He is going potty to the point he also tries a knee slide, but by this time he's on the blue perimeter outside and it's not quite so slippy, and he does a knock out and goes crash onto his face. It's very humorous.
You're winning 3-0, and that's probably when the Palace exodus started. Either that or a few of them came dressed as blue seats, and I mean we know they've got some issues behind the scenes there, they're meant to have this amazing fan base that stays behind the team, whatever.
Well, it was a shame, really, wasn't it? Because they didn't. I was bracing myself for another 95 minutes of droning and firecrackers, but sadly, it appeared that they didn't get tickets. Those ones, the Always Ultras, seem to have missed out on tickets, curiously, because I didn't hear them. So it's a shame, really, a bit mean. As I think I've said on also a bit mean of the club not to give them any tickets.
But we're back to the word, the F word they used earlier, funny. there are kind of pitiful, but the weird thing is that, and let's get back to, I mean, you used the phrase earlier, AD, that Roy threw the medical team under the bus. I'm more inclined to go along Vicky's line, is that, well, certainly Elise has got to take a lot of responsibility. Personally, I think it's a collective responsibility they've got to have for his, but the point is the fans are all just zeroed in on Roy Hodgson, which I think is actually a bit unfair. Like I say, the medical team have got to have some level of responsibility. What the percentage of sort of finger pointing and blame is, I don't know, and frankly, I don't care. I mean, let's throw in the coach driver while we're at it. But a lot of their ire is also directed towards Steve Parish. And I think I was watching in the last couple of years, they've spent £40 million on players, of which £22 million was Henderson. So they're not really investing in a squad at the moment. They have enough just to tread water in the Premier League, and they're far from certs to go down. But I think there's a twofold thing. One, they can see stagnation, and that stagnation is not going to do them any good. But they're viewing it in comparison to us, and that's what really hurts them.
This is what's changed in recent years, because for several years when they got promoted, for several years, you know, they mostly stayed up fairly comfortably. They do the same every year. They'd struggle for a bit, they'd panic, and then they'd sort of put a run together, and then they'd stay up quite comfortably. And that's what they've done for a long time. And then every now and again, they think, oh, do you know what? We could be a bit better here. We'll sack the manager and we'll put someone else in. But because they have no kind of long-term strategy in place, you get the feeling with the Albion, everything is kind of planned to a degree. And there is a strategy there. This is the way we're going to operate, and this is how we're going to run the club. Whereas Palace, I feel that's there. And then they panicked once before, and they sort of, you know, they brought De Boer in, and then they just crapped their pants after six games, I think it was. Six defeats, I also think it was. And then this is our new way of thinking. Oh, no, panic, and then bring back a dinosaur. Then they get rid of, I can't remember if it was Hodgson again, or is it Allardyce that time? I forget. But then they you know, they put Hodgson in, and then they get rid of Hodgson, and they bring in Vieira, and then, you know, he did all right that first season. But then they...
That was it. Vieira was doing really well. And basically, they had a poor run of games. But who were those games against? The games that are coming up were against teams where they would have been targeting to get more points out of. So
what I always say with them is that they lack the courage of their convictions because they don't have that kind of plan in the background. They don't have that strategy. So when they lose a few games, they absolutely crap themselves. This, you know, we lost an awful lot of games. We had that horrific spell under Potter in spring... Can't remember what season it was.
It was his last full season, wasn't it? So that's 2022.
Games, and there was plenty of clubs would have given the manager the gooner at that point. Palace certainly would have given the manager the gooner, but we stuck with it, and we, you know, follow the plan, as it were. You know, trust the process, as I think somebody used to like saying. And then we came through it, and by and large, since then, it's been pretty much up. And the problem is, you know, that, and the Palace don't have the courage to stick with that, so they got rid of Vieira, and then they brought safe old Roy back. And even in the summer, when they had the opportunity to think, right, okay, reassess, we've got some time now, we've got pre-season, we could get somebody else in here. It might be that nobody else wanted it. It might be that there was no managers available of the type that they felt they wanted. There was no kind of Potter type people around, and maybe that was why they stuck with Roy. But I also feel it's because they're just so wildly afraid of relegation that they don't trust themselves. And so they stick with old Roy again, and this is where they're at. Now, you know, but then the worst thing for them in the meantime, that would have been okay if it wasn't for the fact that we've suddenly made all this progress under progressive, you know, younger managers who seem to actually have a clue what they're doing. And for years, they never had that. And suddenly that's what they see when they look around them. And that makes the mid-table mediocrity that they've always been okay with, that's what makes it a million times worse. And that really hurts them. And it's brilliant.
And the weird thing is that, yeah, I 100% agree. And the weird thing is that while everyone else congratulates us and lauds us for doing what we're doing, you know, Ickle Brighton, yes, we remember the story. Hey, here's the story. And even the Palace fans who know the story from 25 years ago and have that tiniest semblance of sympathy towards us are still seeing you think, okay, well, yeah, we can see what they've done. You can even, I suppose it's easier with hindsight. You can plot the path as to what's happened and how it's happened. And the fact is that, and it's not just Parrish, it's no one at Crystal Palace for the last 30 years. I mean, if I was a Palace fan, I'd be curious to ask Steve Parrish, what is your primary target? What is your primary motivation? I mean, if it's just avoiding relegation, then yes, they're going to have these grumbles. But if they don't have a plan as to how their primary target or their primary objective is going to be achieved, they seem to be just a rudderless club that doesn't, that is just almost operating from day to day without a plan. It's, you know, it's, they are a pinball club just going crashing here, crashing there, throwing a few quid at the problem. And I suppose for Chelsea, would be a cautionary tale. But for the fact that Chelsea is obviously clearly a much richer club, they're doing a very similar thing. Perhaps it's a London thing, who knows? But, yeah, it's bizarre that they are, as Vicky says, what was mediocrity and getting in there 120, 130, 150 million pounds every year is now not good enough. And yeah, this is what, I just want to finish this final point. This is what we collectively as Brighton fans were always worried about. Are we going to be satisfied with 14th every year? And I think it scared us. But I think once we had those first four or five seasons of getting over that hump of, you know, clearly being relegation fodder, and then it finally clicking into place after those six defeats in a row that Vicky was talking about, that for me is the kind of that red letter day. I think that was then we then beat Arsenal 2-1. And from there, for me, is the kind of the start of where we are now. It was those last half dozen games in that season, then the first half dozen in the following ones, it gave whoever was going to take over a platform to kick on. We didn't know the extent to how much, but we also are of the ilk, that of the opinion that 14th is now beneath us.
Okay, well, in a minute, we're going to come back and talk about João Pedro. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and, of course, on our podcast. As ever, we're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us something that is quite noisy this week, Vicky.
Noisy in terms of it's got an awful lot of sponsors on it. So it is a kind of, well, it's black and white stripes. It's got a lot of sponsor names all over it. I haven't actually counted, but there must be about 15 or 20 in total.
I can tell you exactly how many, because it says on here.
Okay, I'm going to get, well, the sponsor names are in Portuguese, my limited knowledge tells me, so it's going to be somebody either Portuguese or Brazilian, I would guess, or from Cape Verde at a push, but probably not. I probably should know who a Brazilian team playing in black and white stripes is, but I don't.
You won't.
No, the only Brazilian team I know playing in black, the major team is Botafogo, and that's clearly not their badge. It looks like, to me, it looks like this is what a box of celebrations would look like if Newcastle were to put their own stamp on it. We've just got a ridiculous amount of, like I say, chest sponsors. Somewhere in there, there's a black and white. The badge itself is circular. Phil's mucked about with the name of it. I think it says OFEC 1912. Like I say, it's more of a Formula One kit than a football kit. But if you're going to say it's a team of Portuguese language that we haven't heard of, I think it's probably prudent for you to put us out of our misery.
I'm going to put you out of your misery. And this is exactly what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. He says, right, you lot, you'd be amazed how many times regarding the over-sponsorship of football shirts. But when I saw this one, I had to choose it. Not only that, but I bought it as well. And this is the latest addition to my personal collection. There are 10 different sponsors on the front of this one. A total of 12 logos. On the sleeves, there are 5 different sponsors. And a total of 8 logos. And then on the back, there are a further 3 sponsors. So in total, that makes 23 sponsors' logos in total on one shirt. And this is, of course, the 2023 home shirt of Brazilian side Operário Ferroviário, who play in 2 different leagues, the Campeonato Serie B, which is the second flight of football in Brazil, and also in the Paraná State Campeonato Paranaense, which is just for teams from the state of Paraná. The team was formed in 1912 in the municipality of Ponta Grossa in the southeast of Brazil, and they are the second oldest team in Paraná. Home is the Durano Kruger Stadium, which has a capacity of 10,632. In case you are interested, Curitiba Football Club is the oldest. The team name translates to the Railway Workers Sports Club. And their colours, black and white, was the idea of their founder, Albert Scarapin. It's a tribute to the black and white races, which will always have a place in our club. At the time of their formation, despite Brazil abolishing slavery in all its forms, with the Golden Law in 1888, very few Brazilian teams will allow black players in their sides. Their nicknames seem to be, for no apparent reason, steeped in ghostly goings-on. They go by the names of Fantasma da Via, which means ghost of the town, Fantasma da Via Aficionados, the ghost of the workshop's village, and Tren Fantasma, the ghost train. Despite a long history, honours have been very few and far between. They won Serie A and Serie D once each, the Campeonato Paranaense once, and the Taça Cup once. There's no links to the UK, so you have to enjoy all 23 sponsors. So thanks all over again.
Well done, the marketing person, for managing to get that many sponsors in.
Indeed. Of course, you can see this and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. Now, while we're talking about Brazil, let's talk about our Brazilian player. Now, Vicky, Pedro, he's done brilliantly well for us this season, but at times he has flattered to deceive a little bit. You know, there's been a few things where tricks and flicks aren't coming off, but he's managed to keep himself ticking over by scoring goals, which is but this game against Palace on Saturday, I just think he truly came of age for us, and it was the best performance I've seen from him in the Brighton shirt by a long way.
You know, I feel like maybe he's a bit of a big game type of player. I feel like with him, he's got 19 goals. None of us could have even dreamed that this guy is going to have scored 19 goals by the start of February. And, you know, yes, we paid quite a lot of money for him, but we never expected this return. And I will challenge anyone that actually thought that might be the case. I think he's still nowhere near the finished article. And
no.
I think he still tries so much that doesn't come off. Sometimes there's that. He does a lot when he receives the ball with his back to the opposition's goal and he's trying to flick it around them every time. And when that comes off, it's brilliant. And when it doesn't, or when he's not quite up for it, and the Luton game is a case in point where he was abysmal and I don't know how he lasted as long as he did. But he just wasn't up for it that night. And whether their crowd got to him a little bit with the abuse he was getting for being an ex-Watford player, just wasn't on it at all. I thought on Saturday, he was fantastic. Again, I still thought it wasn't a 10 out of 10 performance for me. I'm perhaps being a little bit of a perfectionist here, but I thought there's still so much about him that he can improve. But that's one of the things I really like, because he's got 19 goals. He's playing every week. He's doing really, really well for us. And yeah, he's nowhere near as good as I think he can be. So actually, there's a huge amount of that. That's exciting to have a player like that. And, you know, you'd like to think he'll be getting another call up for the Brazil team soon as well. And also just to have someone that confidently takes penalties, because I thought once McAllister's gone, that was going to be a struggle given our previous track record. Yeah. But yeah, it's fantastic, but plenty of room to improve.
We certainly have been critical and possibly rightly so. But I mean, 19 goals spin through itself, doesn't
it? Well, the thing is, I mean, there are sort of so many aspects, and I don't think it's right to judge him on the goals alone, because if you're going to do that, then you'd have a downer on Evan Ferguson. And of course, they both contribute to the game. And Pedro's got 19, Welbeck's got however many he's got, Ferguson. And if these three are going to be judged by goals alone, then of course, you know, Welbeck and Ferguson are out of the club. And of course, it doesn't work like that. It's actually about their contribution and their work rate. And yes, it's not so much Pedro's work rate, which I don't think was ever in doubt. It was his, as you say, appropriate play. And I think that the main irritating ones were certainly in the first game against Ajax, when he was just trying to over-elaborate. And I think he did it a couple of games after that as well. Somewhere down the line, he was told, just keep it simple. I think one of his things, and it probably is a case of getting used to De Zerbi ball, was that whole thing of when Jason Steele's standing on the ball, there is that pass that they play through the centre of the midfield, to the retreating forward. And there was a couple of times where you could see him on his heels and still play that ball, expecting Pedro or maybe someone else, but Pedro to come back and get it. And of course, the defender is a bit more alert to it. So he's improving that way. He still probably could improve his touch when he does receive that ball. But like you say, at least you see he's not regressing yet. I think probably with your point about Luton, Vicky, I think that probably with that game, I think everyone had a stinker. And when everyone has a stinker, then you lose 4-0. And we were lucky to get nil.
I agree, but I think his head was very noticeably dropped in that game. I think the rest of them, probably him and Buonanotte, I think were the ones that were really struggling with the kind of atmosphere and the fact that it was not going well at all. I think you could see players like Dunk, who were also having bad games, but they're still shouting at the others and come on, we've got to try to get it going.
Yeah.
I might be doing him an injustice here, but I got the impression he'd had enough. He lost his rag. That's how he managed to get injured in inverted commas. Right. Outlook. He lost his
rag. But he did leave in a leg brace. So.
And then went and hacked at the opponent. And I just felt, I wondered at the time how injured he actually was, or if I've had enough tonight, it's not happening. So be it. He was certainly fit for Saturday, wasn't he? Which goes to show, hopefully, that it wasn't a big draw.
But if we're gonna judge him if we're talking about the Palace game, obviously the standout moment is the goal.
What a goal! What an assist! And what a celebration!
Well, there's several parts of that. I mean, you don't rule out Van Hecker's point in this, and that was a ball straight from front to back, and it was only probably about 30 yards. It held the Palace backed off, which was nice. But if you're going to do that, it's, you know, in me watching it and saw the back heel. That back heel, by the way, can easily go wrong. We've seen that go wrong. the very thing that we've been criticising Pedro for is the exact thing Welbeck does. I mean, like you, as you say, Vicky, when he does it right, it's amazing, and it just sort of plants it in his path, and he does the one thing he needs to do, stick in the back of the net, and yeah, you can see the 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the chop across the neck. He does it twice, perhaps just in case anyone missed it first time round.
Yes.
I thought it was actually 1, 2, 3, 4, stop, but someone else said it was 1, 2, 3, 4, something else. I'm not sure.
Yeah, there was a slit across the throat.
Game over, wasn't it?
Yeah,
something like that.
That's why I read it.
The BBC very kindly edited that out from a match of the day.
Yeah, but no.
Not on the end credits, they didn't. If you watch the end credits, they do the throat cutting, but they left it in with the final beats of the music, which fitted beautifully. It's great.
I'll have to have a look at that, yeah. No, very interesting. I mean, I'll tell you what, he looked furious. It wasn't obvious. There was not a smile on his face. Even when the rest of the players came over to celebrate with him, I mean, he still looked like he had his tail on fire. Well,
he's only got one goal. Maybe he fancied his chances against that defence. But I think the other thing with him is that it's quite notable his finishing has improved, because I think earlier in the season, he was missing some proper sitters. Not that he doesn't steal occasionally, but he's started to score more goals from open play now.
Yes.
And despite what people like to say, it's not all about the penalties in it. I think he's on about half and half now. I think he's got 8 Premier League goals, hasn't he? I'm not sure quite how many of them are penalties, but he's starting to score from open play, which must be really good for his confidence.
All I'd ever say is that it's actually there's the one thing that, with the pre-season predictions that we have, it's the one thing that's proved me right, because in AD asking who's going to be our leading scorer this season, I did say just purely because he takes the penalties. And let's face it, last season's penalty taker was our leading scorer. So, yeah, the person who takes the penalties. But like you say, 19 is still a hell of an impressive return. And I've got a feeling that...
That's incredible. I mean, he's clearly going to get over 20 goals this season. He's clearly not going to get over 20 goals.
Yeah, that's it. No, 19. That's it. It's... You know, just play Paul Hardcastle at the end and that'll do us. Yeah, we're done. It was superbly done. I've got to say this about the Palace's goal in between time. Yeah, it was, you know, we can't keep a clean sheet, but if you're not going to keep a clean sheet, I would say, as poorly marked as
Mateta
was, I thought it was a hell of a header, because it was basically...
He only had a chance to score against us.
Because he's a... Agent, he's a terrible, terrible footballer.
That's why he scores against us.
Yeah, that's it. Well, it was an absolutely wonderful goal, and obviously it was the icing on the cake. There was nearly a cameo goal for Ansu Fati at the end, who just couldn't quite turn in Gross's deflected shot. That would have been just to make it 5 would have been just brilliant. That would have been.
Yeah, but if you're going to be, for me. And I'm probably being churlish here. A lot of people have said, "Yeah, that's 2002. That's, you know, we have our revenge."
Oh, I still remember.
I don't think so. No, we've got to get a 5-goal clear win in order to avenge that. Don't get me wrong.
I'm comfortable with it, because, you know, that was a championship game, wasn't it? It was a long time ago. I'm all right with this now, because whatever happens, for the first time in my lifetime, to be fair, we have plunged them into a hit of absolute misery and self-reflection. And they don't like what they see. I'm enjoying every minute of it. I'm back to work tomorrow. One of my staff is a Palace fan. I can't wait to see him. I cannot wait to see him.
Well, you know, Vicky, teaches the pupils.
The Germans have a word for it, don't they? And I know, and I'm completely and utterly absorbed in that at the moment. I can't avoid it, as Pascal Gross would say. You know, it's just
Schadenfreude.
And I am all over this. It's not going to last forever.
It's Pascal Gross, isn't it? I've always Pascal Gross.
They've had years to gloat, and I am going to live it, every minute of it.
I do take your point about this compared to the 2002 game, because at least this time around we beat them on the level playing field, where last time we were with Dean, it was a scratch team. They were one of the top sides of the championship. To compare us with them at the time was really unfair, because we were home, you know, because. Yeah. But this time around, you're right, it's a level playing field. It's the first time we've scored 4 against them for over 60 years.
Since 1957.
Yeah.
It's definitely a top-flight win between either team.
Yep. First time either side has scored 4 against the other in the top flight. And
keep them coming.
Yeah, I mean, we could add all the stats to it. I mean, let's do the historical stuff. We've doubled them three times. They've doubled us once. We've applied for re-election once. They had to do it three times. We have 42 wins, so they're 38. We've scored a lot more goals than them. They smell, we don't. there are so many things. But like you say, I mean, it's their IRE is based on their club's owner's intransigence rather than the belligerence of our club owner in the late 90s to actually completely and utterly try and destroy us. So, yeah, it's a level playing field. We've turned them over. And, hey, if Everton and Palace go down at the end of this season, then I'd say it's job done because, let's face it, it's our fault that Everton didn't go down.
That's the only downer, isn't it? That all, for all of their wailing and gnashing of the teeth and poor old us that's going on these last couple of days, there is no way on earth they go down. They could be a disaster for the rest of the season. They could keep Roy Hodgson in. The conversations that I've heard this week are that the only reason Hodgson hasn't been sacked so far is because no one else good wants the job. They've sounded out people like Potter and Steve Cooper and Lopetegui, and they've all gone, yeah, not really. Don't fancy that much right now.
No.
And yet they won't go down because they managed to be this crap in a season where points deductions are likely to be a factor, where Sheffield United and Burnley are both awful. They're just unflushable, aren't they? They are just unflushable.
Okay, let's move on then. And there's been some news in the fixture calendar this week where, I mean, obviously this game against Palace, first time we've played at home on a Saturday forever. I can't remember the last time. But we've now got three games that are moved to Sundays, one of them being the Liverpool game, which is now on Easter Sunday. And so good luck to people who were planning on going to that game by train, because you can't. There are no trains out of Euston on Easter Sunday.
Yeah, it's...
To be fair, the same will apply to a lot of the Liverpool fans, so...
Exactly. Cannot be awkward. No, it's the conversation of years past. You know, it started way before we joined the Premier League. Of, you know, fans are the last people to be considered. I mean, the number of times we played Newcastle at a 5:30 kickoff, either home or away,
or 12:30 at home,
or that, well, yeah, whatever it is, the time that is actually impossible not to get to the game without either A, living a lot closer, or B, staying over. Which, don't get me wrong, is great for the local economy, but it means you have to sort of pick and choose your games a lot more carefully. I could say it's just one of those things. It really isn't. I mean, it is an appalling disgrace. And it really is because they have the TV companies have their quotas of who's going to play how many times. And obviously they top heavy themselves with the big six. And I still include Chelsea in that. For some reason, Chelsea seem to be box office. Maybe just as schadenfreude for the rest of us. But they are the ones who are given priorities. And if they don't have them in a given time, in a given space, in a given window, then everything else has to get shunted around for it. And if that means that we're going to move Liverpool to the Sunday, for example, that's not to say that's what's happened here, but everything has, you know, you move one game, it almost certainly has a knock-on effect on the next one.
What's added to that now is the sort of 35 separate legs of the Jurgen Klopp farewell tour.
Yes.
Every minute must be televised. So I think that doesn't probably help either.
No. I mean, have they moved it to Sunday for the telly?
Yeah. Obviously, we've got to go to Wolves first. And they've just announced their ticket prices for this, which were very helpful. Thanks.
Well, what have they done? I haven't really actually looked.
So basically, I mean, obviously, I mean, the... But I think they've limited it at £30 for everybody, which is fine. But it's for an FA Cup game, which a lot of their fans are not particularly. But I mean, Fulham did this the other day. They charged stupid amounts for a game.
To be fair, Fulham are the ones who are charging stupid money. I mean, they're charging an absolute fortune for tickets in their new stand. I mean, it looks absolutely amazing, but they're charging stupid money. And I can only assume they've got a bad business structure there, or it costs more than they were intended, because they're really milking everyone to try and get that money back.
And I think it did, because they were another one, a bit like Liverpool, where the company that were building that stand went bust.
Yeah.
Remember the name of the constructor, but they went bust, didn't they? Halfway through, went into administration. So both of them have had to source new contractors, new stuff, and that's why it's cost them. That's why it's delayed it, but also it's cost them a lot of money.
Absolutely. So yes, there was a huge boycott. I think they were charging sort of, you know, 48 quid for a ticket, and they weren't exactly playing high flying opposition. So 30 quid for Wolves actually on a Tuesday night does sound steep. I mean, considering what do they charge at Stoke? Was it a 10 or 15 quid, something like
that? Yeah, same as Sheffield United.
Which was what?
So Sheffield United would think was 15, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And in both cases, I mean, neither really filled it, did they? So, I don't know.
These guys, because I mean, obviously, I mean, generally speaking, with the cup tickets aren't included with season tickets, and not all season ticket holders go to these games. And if you do cut the ticket prices on these games, if there are going to be not as highly attended as others, it's an opportunity for people who don't ordinarily go to actually go, for kids to go for the first time. You know, it's missing a trick a little bit with that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's totally missing a trick. I mean, even if we've got Man City in the sixth round at home, all right, getting past Wolves, then there's no way that I'd like to think they're not going to charge full whack the way that they are for the round of 16 game in the Europa League. I mean, me and Chaz, you know, who I've sat next to at football for the last sort of 30-odd years, we've actually decided to move to the West Stand up of Wings just because the tickets are kind of 10, 12, 15 quid cheaper. That's not to say we can't afford it, but I think one, we just want to see it from a different view. But secondly, 44 quid to sit where I would normally sit, I think is, let's put it this way, I wouldn't be happy if it was the FA Cup. Don't get me wrong, we could be playing AC Milan. Do you pay through the nose for that privilege? Well, it's not going to happen too many times again in the future. So you can see why the club is trying to max out on it, especially if we do get the likes of AC Milan. That could seriously curtail our lust for glory in Dublin at the end of May. So I could see why the club are doing that. However, it's still 44 quid. It's still a bit eye-watering.
Yeah. Okay, well, this weekend we travel to Spurs, and obviously we don't normally preview the games out, but I mean, this one, obviously we've got a little bit of a history coming in from last season. And obviously we're going to be doing it without Roberto on the bench because he picked up another yellow card and is now suspended.
Yeah, which he actually forgot about, which is quite funny. So, but I don't think he minds. He said, I think the first game that we played last season when he was up in the stands instead, I think it was the 4-0 against West Ham. So, you know, we've got previous on this and I'm okay with it. We stuck four past Spurs, you know, a few weeks ago and then took our foot off their throat. Are we going to be able to do that again? It's just, I think it's just last time. Well, we beat them fairly and squarely last time. It's just that we had to score five goals just in order to get a draw against the team that scored two. Just as long as we don't get a ref that's as hopelessly corrupt and useless as that, then, you know, it gives us a better fighting chance, I think.
We've got one of the new Premier League refs for that one. I don't think we've had him before. I can't remember his name, but I've not heard of him. He's the official, and then the VAR or SAR, as some people might suggest, is Jared Gillett. So who knows what we're going to get with that game, but it can't be as shambolic a refereeing performance and a VARing performance as last year. Surely.
Well, that is it. And thank you so much to Vicky Rees. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham, and this has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week. Bye.
Facundo! Gol! Che gol hiciste! Gol! Buonanno, 1-0, un gol infernal del pibe ex Rosario Central.
In 1965, Vietnam seemed like just another foreign war, but it wasn't. It was different in many ways, and and so were those who did the fighting. In World War II, the average age of the combat soldier was 26. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19. In Vietnam, he was 19.
I wasn't really sure what was going on.